The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I have one announcement I'd like to make, and that is supposed to give a plug for this auction that we're having, online auction. And there's a lot of it was inspiration to do this came out of our community. A number of people came to me and came to us and said, we really like to offer an auction. And we thought, it was a lot of work, but they wanted to do the work. It was a lot of work, and but it's a very beautiful offering they did. And then a lot of people offered all kinds of things, things and services and stuff. And a lot of it's, there's pictures of it out there so you can see. And most of you know, the purpose of it is to raise money for our retreat center renovation. And this is probably the last idea we have about how to raise money. Because we're about, we've raised a phenomenal amount of money. I'm very grateful for all the people who've donated for it. And I never would have imagined we would have raised as much money as we did. And I never imagined it was going to cost as much as it did either. So we're actually about $83,000 short from what would be good for us. And if we don't raise that 83, probably we're going to have to cut back on some of the project. So this is like the last, And here you get something. And so you can look at the things and see, and you can just double thing, right? You get something, and then you get to it's all a donation to the retreat center. It's all been given, what's the offer. And we realize that some of you don't want anything. So, when we had our fundraising party a couple of weekends ago, we auctioned off nothing. With great success. We actually, someone paid $1,100 for nothing. And the person who came in second didn't want to be left behind, so he gave us $1,000 for really nothing. And we don't have nothing on the auction because we couldn't get a picture of it. But for those of you who would like, nothing, you can let us know and we'll provide you with a certificate certifying that you'll get an authentic piece of nothing. Unless you give us too little money. If you give us too little, whatever that is, for nothing, then we'll give you, since it's almost, we'll give you almost nothing. In the form of a certificate that says that you'll get an authentic replica of nothing. So whether you want something or want nothing, we have it for you. So it's the auction, I think, is one more week. It's online, and so this is the last week. So if you haven't looked at it, you might go online and look at it. So at the heart of what our practice here at IMC is, I suppose, would be mindfulness. But in the Buddhist context, mindfulness is usually considered not enough. Usually, mindfulness occurs in a wider context of practice, training, reflection, contemplation, teachings. And one of the ways to put it in a wider context is to do the regular, what's recommended, a daily reflections, particular reflections or contemplations or reminders of certain things. And there's a long tradition in Theravada Buddhism that every day before meditating, someone would memorize these and recite them to oneself. And in doing so, seeing what comes up. And these are the five reflections. I am subject to aging. Aging is unavoidable. I am subject to illness. Illness is unavoidable. I am subject to death. Death is unavoidable. I will grow different, separate from all that is dear and appealing to me. And then the last reflection is, I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related through my actions, and live dependent on my actions. Whatever I do, for good or for evil, to that will I fall heir. So these are the five reflections, and when people do these on a regular basis, it's interesting to notice what comes up, the feelings, the emotions, the thoughts, the reflections that occur around this. And it puts mindfulness practice in a little different context than, or a very different context than mindfulness as stress reduction, or mindfulness as, you know, there's a lot of reasons to practice mindfulness, but this creates a certain context that mindfulness occurs in the face of some of the great existential issues that we all have to face. So a little bit what I want to focus on today is the contemplation of death. When the Buddha taught mindfulness practice in the Satipatthana Sutta, he did it including a section on contemplation or mindfulness of death, of a corpse. And again, there's a long tradition of people actively in Theravada Buddhism actively taking on the subject of death as a reflection. I did this for a year, where every day I contemplated what would it be like if I knew I was going to die tonight. So this was my last day. And it was very interesting to do that for the year and to watch the shifts and changes inside of me as I reflected on it, and different feelings came up, different thoughts came up, different intentions, different things that I wanted to do came up. And it was interesting to see what I wanted to do if I had knew I had 12 hours left. And it certainly made a certain poignancy to my life during that year, or a certain kind of strength to the reflection of the context in which I was doing this. In the face of death, what's important? In the face of death, what do you have left to do? In the face of death, what do you want to do? In the Buddhist tradition, there's a lot of direct and indirect ways in which this contemplation of death is encouraged. And one is in the myths that Buddhists tell. The stories Buddhists like to tell each other. And a lot of them have to do with death is kind of in the picture. So I mean, even the life of the Buddha, which is very popularly told, most of it I think is just a myth, but myths carry a certain truth to them, the kind of symbolic value that we see our own lives in them in an interesting way and help with that reflection. And but often in presenting kind of contemplation of death in these stories, it's not death by itself, but rather it's often a contrasted with an alternative, not exactly an alternative to death, but an alternative way of being in relationship to death compared to how most people are. So for example, the Buddha's life is bounded, or kind of beginning and end of it, by this contrast. The the beginning of it, when he was born, his mother died. Within 7 days of his birth, his mother died. And we don't know, you know, I don't know what memories, visceral memories he might have, or the impact that has on a seven-year-old, but I suspect it's quite deep to have a mother die. And certainly later, as he grew up, and he really understood what his loss was. And that's a very, very primal, deep challenge. It's been pointed out that a number of the great religious leaders of the world, figures of the world, lost a parent. So something about that suffering, that loss, that propels a person to go deeper or search further than people who maybe are more comfortable. And so so that's on one hand. One end of the Buddha's life is the death of his mother at his birth. And the other end of his life is his own death. And the way the myth is presented is he died very peacefully, outdoors under flowering trees that were dropping their petals on the ground. And he knew that he was dying. He spoke his last words to his followers in a beautiful way, caring for them. And then he entered into meditation, and in his meditation state, he passed away very peacefully, not afraid. There's lots and lots of stories in Buddhism of I think a good number of them must be true, of Buddhist teachers who consciously died in meditation posture or in meditation. Their time had come. They were old. So that's one, you know, one's kind of the contrast. The other contrast is that between the time of the Buddha first encountering sickness, old age, and death, and resolving his anxiety, his despair, the issues he had around it, so that he could be at peace in the context of this life that we live. And so, in the myth, you know, it wasn't until he was 29 that for the first time he really encountered sickness, old age, and death in such a way that it caused him to do something different, caused him to kind of change the direction of his life, to search for some way of living, some possibility of freedom, some way of liberation from the oppressiveness or the challenges or the suffering of that he experienced of sickness, old age, and death. And, you know, the myth is that he didn't see anybody who was sick, old, or dead until he was 29, which seems a little odd, especially in India. Not so odd for maybe people growing up in some of the more comfortable suburbs of America, where that's not, those things aren't so evident. I saw my first corpse when I was 11, but not in the suburbs of Los Angeles where I grew up, but rather on the streets of Kathmandu, when they were carrying a child down to the river to be cremated. But somehow, when the Buddha was 29, is when something clicked inside of him. And the question is, you know, for all of us, I think most, you know, we grow up, and as we're growing up as a child, often there's not a lot of thought in the sickness, old age, and death. I don't think, occasionally it's prominent in a young child's life. But, it's not kind of part and parcel of what goes through their minds. And then at some point, as a teenager, a young adult, maybe not until you're 70 or 80 or 90, there's a kind of a wake-up call. It's kind of wait a minute, what's going on here? There's something very significant here. This death thing is really important. And so what happens in that encounter with death, the meeting of death? How are people changed? Some people are motivated by it to change their life dramatically. I remember many years ago I did a workshop on death and dying. And I did a guided meditation on dying, where I had people imagine that they were, they were going to die in the next, I forget exactly, but it's progressively shorter periods of time, 3 days, 1 day, 4 hours, 1 hour, 10 minutes, they had 1 minute left, and then it was now. So it was a guided meditation, so people are kind of very settled and quiet, and the mind and kind of their imagination kind of follow along with this. And sometime a little after that workshop, a woman who was there said, "Gil, that was really significant, that meditation, because after coming out of that meditation, I decided to give up my job." And I gulped. What have I done? But, you know, she was getting close to retirement age, so like she decided to retire. And I still know her, you know, this was 15 years ago, and she's very happy having left her job. But somehow, the encounter with death in that meditation had her question what she was doing and what she wanted to do with the life that she had. So at some point, we have an encounter with death that changes us. And it might be interesting to ask for a show of hands, how many of you have had an encounter with death that you've been changed? So it looks like maybe half of you. And the other half of you will. It will come. I guarantee it. And so, you know, is there a way of being changed that's for your betterment? Is there a way of being changed that's for the betterment not of you, but for the world around you? What are the ways to be changed by it? I've known people who have tried to deny death or facing it or dealing with it as much as they possibly can. I've known someone who's 80 who just refused to talk about it. You know, you bring up the topic of death and just, you know, it's brushed off quickly and, you know, don't talk about depressing things. And so it's possible to keep it at bay for a long time. But then there's the encounter with death, the meeting of it. So the Theravadin tradition recommends reflecting on this experience. Don't deny it, don't push it away, but to look more deeply at the experience of death. And as I've said already, they often do it, teachers do it, in the stories that they tell. So I want to tell another story. And this is a story which is often told and retold in the Theravadin tradition quite a bit. It's told in many different ways. You know, as storytellers do, they embellish a story sometimes. And it's probably a myth. I don't know if it happened this way. And this is the story of a woman whose first name was Frail. And perhaps of the same clan as the Buddha, because her other name was Gotami, female for Gautama, the clan, the Gautama clan, the Buddha came from. And so Frail Gotami, Kisa Gotami. And the story that's told is that Kisa Gotami was she wasn't a untouchable, she wasn't but she was kind of a low-class person who was not really of any status or importance in people's eyes, and kind of very frail, maybe weak, maybe sickly. And I've heard one story where it says that she was the daughter of nobody, which is not, you know. And in ancient India, you know, how do you support yourself into adulthood and old age? And, you know, there wasn't any social services available, or, you know, and job opportunities were few and far between if you didn't have, you know. So what do you do? And then at some point she got married, and as is somewhat sometimes happens, the in-laws treated her pretty badly. It's kind of dismissive of her, for she was frail, she was a daughter of nobody. And until she had a son. And when she had a son, she became happy and she had a place in the family. Her status went up. She had, one of the duties of a wife in ancient India was to produce a son. And she did that. And so things were looking up for her. But then her husband died, who was a little bit of protection from the family, but still living with this in-law family. But she had a son. And sometime after the son could start walking, maybe 2 years old or something, the son died as well. And so it's bad enough, you know, for a parent to lose a young child. But, you know, there was so much more embedded in being a mother of a son in her life and in her social condition, you know, in her own security and well-being was so deeply tied to this, you know, having a son. And so she became a little bit, some people would say deranged, but she became a little bit, she refused to admit that her son had died. And so she bundled him up in a bundle of cloth and went walking around the village, towns, knocking at doors, carrying this corpse of her son on her hip. And she would say, do you have any medicine for my son? He's sick. And people would say no. Some people were very impolite, would kind of deride her, pushed her away. Some people were horrified. Some people were scared. You know, what kind of disease is being carried by, you know, a corpse of a son? But she refused to admit that the son was dead. So finally, someone who had a little bit of caring for her, you know, could see what was going on for her, said, you know, maybe there's someone who can help you. And said, there's, you know, outside the village in the woods there resides the Buddha. Why don't you go see him? And so she went to the Buddha, and the Buddha kind of was sitting under the tree peacefully. And here we have the contrast between someone who's deranged or caught up in the worlds of attachments and clinging and fear and resistance and pain. And the Buddha, who'd gone through, done it, was faced at those things as well, but come to the other side of it, where he had come to some deep abiding sense of peace in this world. So imagine he was sitting there peacefully, maybe meditation posture under a tree, and in his calm way received her. And perhaps because he recognized that she was not of sound mind, there had to be an intervention that was creative. And so the creative intervention was, he said, yes, there is medicine for your son. So you can imagine that gets her attention. Maybe brings her out a little bit of her mind state. And what you have to do is go into town and collect mustard seeds from homes that have never been visited by death. No one's ever died there, no connection. Mustard seeds are extremely common. Everyone probably in India has mustard seeds in their kitchen. So she was thought, oh, great. So perhaps with a sense of hope and aspiration, also being brought her a little bit out of her sorrow and her despair, so she can maybe see a little more clearly again. And then she went to knocked on doors and said, do you have mustard seed? Oh yeah, we have mustard seed. Imagine her excitement. And then, but before you give it to me, I have to ask you a question. Has anybody died in this household? Oh, let me tell you. Not just one or two or ten. We've lived here for many generations. Many people have died here. Oh, I'm sorry, then I can't use your mustard seed. Should you go to the next house? And the same thing she asked, is there a mustard seed? Yes, but people have died here too. And so she went on and on and on and asking, until finally the stories of other people die as well. Other people have had losses. Other people have lost their parents, their children, their spouse, their siblings, all kinds of things that have happened. And perhaps, maybe, you know, rather than being kind of lost in her own suffering, maybe hearing the stories of others pulled her out of herself a little bit, allowed her to see the universality of death, the universality of this human experience, that everyone has to face this. It's not just for few people. It's not for the people down the street. And so then, realizing that death is universal, it's said that she uttered the following verse. No law of market town, no law of a single house is this. Of all the world and all the worlds of gods, this only is the law, that all things are impermanent. So then she understood, in the entire city this must be the way. The Buddha, full of compassion for the welfare of all of us, must have seen this. Then, overcome with emotion, she went outside the city and carried her son to the burning ground, and holding him in her arms, said, dear little son, I thought that you alone had been overtaken by this thing called death. But you are not the only one death has overtaken. This is a law common to all people. So saying, she placed her son in the burning ground. And then it says that she then went back to the Buddha, and the Buddha gave her teachings, and she became ordained. And then she became one of the great realized women of the early Buddhist tradition. So, you know, I think it's useful to take this as a myth rather than a real thing that happened. Partly because I think we can then it's easier to kind of pull out of it dip into it with our hearts more deeply, or look at ourselves in the story. And one of the interesting elements of the story is that the bundle she carried with her, so she wouldn't face death, or held death at bay. And what is the bundle that you have to put down? What bundle do you carry with you that stands in the way of you being at peace with the experience of death? And the idea of a bundle you're carrying that be put down, sooner or later, the task of anybody who's going to live a life that I think that's mature and wise and conducive to some level of a peaceful heart, is everybody's going to have to learn how to let go. And you're welcome to put it off, but sooner or later we're going to have to let go of something. And as this says here in the fourth reflection, I will grow different and separate from all that is dear and appealing to me. Everything that's dear to you, you're going to be separated from sooner or later. And so, given sooner or later you'll die, they'll die, things will disappear. So, if you could, if you hold on to those, certainly it'll be difficult. Is there a wise way, beautiful way, graceful way, of learning to let go, so that the inevitable losses and inevitable changes we have, that they don't lead to further anguish, but to lead to some kind of deep peace? I've known enough people who have died peacefully to know that it's possible to die at peace, and I've known people who've died in anguish. Little bit people die in character of how they've lived their lives. And if we live our lives clinging, holding on, avoiding, denying, never really looking deeply at things, then chances are that dying will be difficult. But if we live a life where we actually look at these things and work with them and sit with them, I think it's, there's a possibility of having a good death. So the contemplation of death is considered important. And learning, and then contemplation of death hopefully helps us to work through some of the different issues that we have to, we would need to work through in order to come to a peaceful death or be peaceful about it, to no longer be afraid of death or anxious about it. And some of it has to do with having meaning in our life. What meaning do we have in our life? What sense of purpose do we have? Another is the healing or reconciliation of relationships. Many people, in order to work through their relationship to death in a healthy way, need to reconcile themselves with broken relationships. One of the broken relationships that many people have is the relationship with themselves, where in some ways that they feel or they think that they're inadequate or bad or wrong or at fault. It's possible to have such a deeply embedded feeling of being at fault or being bad that there does not be a reason for it. If you ask a person why, that's besides the point, because the psyche carries this ideation. When I was younger, I said that Gil was short for guilt. because I could be guilty for no reason at all. I had the great capacity, kind of a guilt genius, aptitude for guilt. Didn't have to have a reason for it. And so to reconcile that, to kind of work through that, so that it doesn't carry with us as we get older. As people get older into old age, sometimes the defense mechanism we have or the compensation mechanisms we have to cover over some of these things begin to not be available so much anymore. And so some of these deeper complexes begin showing themselves more strongly unless they work through. And then, so sense of purpose and meaning, what do you have that allows you to face death? What is it, what's unresolved in your life that's best to resolve so you can face death? And then what are the attachments you're holding on to? What are things we cling to? What forms of greed, hate, and delusion? What forms of holding on to desire, holding on to resistance would be good to work through and find yourself the other side of. One of the probably the thing that has helped me the most in terms of looking death in the face and coming to some resolution with it, some peace with the idea of death, so much so that my feeling now about dying, I don't know how it's going to be, and I don't want to overestimate my, you know, how difficult it might, underestimate how difficult it might be for me. I don't know, you know, how it's going to be and what will stir it up as I die for me. But the attitude I have, at least now, that I have had now for many, many years, is that if I can die consciously and slow enough, I look forward to it. So rather than something that I'm afraid of. I mean, I don't want to die soon because I have kids, and there's all kinds of reasons why. But if it's just left to myself, and don't think about anybody else, then the idea of dying in a slow way, conscious way, hopefully without too much pain, is actually very welcoming to me, the experience of it. Because, and the reason for that is because I associated with some of the deep experiences of letting go that I've had in meditation practice. She's over there. Coming with the flyers. So thank you for bringing them. So there's something of deep letting go and letting go and letting go and letting go in meditation. And for me, this might be idiosyncratic with me, it's been very meaningful to sit for long periods of time in meditation. Just sit still, sitting in meditation halls, very still and quiet, without the normal things that the mind picks up on, without the normal concern with social relationships, without the concern with wanting things, wanting comfort, not comfort, concerns with health. I mean, the mind can have so many concerns that it has, but to sit in a situation for still and quiet and let go of all concerns. And the way that I kind of experienced it sometimes was sitting there looking, you know, my eyes were closed, so it made maybe a little bit of sense with the darkness, but looking deeply into the universe, looking into the vast emptiness, vast, at least in the universe. And to me, it was something very profound about just sitting there still and quiet and looking into the deep universe, the vast space, vast emptiness, and in a sense, disappearing in that. And feeling that it was something really right, really, really perfect, really meaningful, really satisfying, really peaceful, but not holding on to anything, not needing anything. And even the fear that that's not enough, any reaction to that great spacious emptiness, that's where that's not okay, let go of that too. Let go, let go, let go. And for me, that staring into the deep, open emptiness of the universe became something very comforting and meaningful. And so the idea of just letting go into that, to me, is very, very comparable to the idea of what might happen, my idea I have of what might happen with dying. Of course, I don't know. So I can't tell you what will actually happen for me. So an interesting question for you is, how do you want to be changed by the meeting with death? How would you like to be changed by it? Have you thought about that? How have you been changed? How would you like to be changed for your betterment? How could you encounter it and face it? For some people, it means facing their fears and working through it. It's very interesting, the fears that are connected to death. Not a few people are not afraid of being dead. That doesn't bother them. What they're afraid of is the dying process. They're afraid of the pain and a variety of things, the indignations, and various things that might happen as we die. Or what is it that people are afraid around death? And is it the loss of a relationship? Is it a loss of status, loss of control, loss of, you know, what is it? What, so it's a very interesting exploration. What are we afraid of when we're afraid of death? So the contrast of the Buddha losing his mother as a young man, and then the Buddha himself dying peacefully. The contrast of the Buddha somehow being stirred up by his encounter with sickness, old age, and death, and then doing his long search. And at the end of that search of practice, finding a resolution, finding a letting go, finding something that allowed him then to be deeply at peace in the face of sickness, old age, and death. This idea of deeply being at peace in the face of sickness, old age, and death, I'll end the talk with an image. It's kind of powerful for me. I don't know what it'll do for you, if you understand it, but maybe you can use your imagination to this little image and see. There's a way in which when the mind is completely open, the awareness is open, uncontracted, when the awareness is not caught by anything, mind doesn't want anything, it doesn't resist anything, but what's salient, what stands out, is the great openness, expansiveness, peacefulness of the mind, kind of like in the way that we look into the, you know, we look at the Hubble photographs of deep space, you know, just wow. When the mind's that open and peaceful and empty, sickness, old age, and death are like painting with watercolors on a moving stream. Sickness and old age and death. It's like painting with watercolors on a moving stream. So, we have five minutes. And would you like to ask any questions about this, or comments, or testimonials about how you've been changed in the encounter of death?
Thank you, Gail.
Uh-huh.
The subject and the topic of death is certainly very deep and loving for me, actually. Loving. I've been contemplating on that, but I had a challenge. I'm attached to visualizing, you know, visuals when I do thinking or, you know, meditation or some kind of contemplation. But today, your talk really helped me. Now, it gave me a lot of comfort. I will be using the visual of me sitting and meditating when I'm very close to death. That really helped me. That's one of the things which actually nags me when I think about death. You know, I used to use me lying down on the bed, you know, everyone sitting next to me, you know, expressing, oh, sorry, you're going to die and all that. I don't really like that. You know, and now, me in the open space, closer to the nature, you know, I'm meditating and with complete awareness. Wow, that's a great feeling. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm afraid inside, but I would certainly want to say I'm not afraid anymore.
Beautiful. Yeah, so, you know, it's nice, for some people it's nice to be able to die with their relatives and loved ones around them. That's supportive. But, you know, it seems that sometimes the senses begin going before we die, and sometimes we don't, apparently, you can still be alive and not know anybody's around you anymore. So you're left there alone. So if you have the ability to be at peace in that great aloneness, it can be pretty good. So, one more.
I recently was doing some contemplation of death practice, reflections on death. And what I noticed, I all of a sudden, this happened on retreat. I headed into the kitchen to help make the salad, and I've never been so present making a salad and tearing up the lettuce. It was just suddenly I want to be awake. I want to be right here. And I've made so many salads, and I probably will make more salads, but it was this, just that I want to be right here with this salad. I'm never going to make this salad again. And, of course, you know, that insight doesn't stay with me, but I was really grateful for that teaching and the experience.
That's one of the benefits some people find from the contemplation of death, is it makes them really emphasize their value this moment of life, the lived life as it's being lived now. And so whether it's salad or talking with a friend or going for a walk or doing your work, to really feel the poignancy and the liveness of here, because where else is life going to be? Okay, so thank you. And if any of you are new today and you'd like to meet someone, Judith, who just spoke, is our greeter today. Please say hello to her. And then I wish you all well. And I liked what you said about the contemplation of death being something loving about that, that there's love there in that. So thank you all.